Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go.
Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, and historians to talk about wars and history.
Today's guest is a very special guest. General George Casey, who was a retired four-star general who served as the 36th Chief of Staff of the United States Army and previously commanded the multinational force in Iraq during the Iraq War.
He serves on multiple boards supporting veterans and military families, and he's also the author of today's book, Strategic Reflections, Operation Iraqi Freedom, July 2004 to February 2007, which is an awesome book.
General Casey, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Emily. Nice to be here with you.
We are very lucky to be able to sit down and chat with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what your job was as the U.S. Army Chief of Staff?
Sure. While I was the Army Chief of Staff, while my memory of Iraq was still good, I worked very hard to capture some of the lessons that I took from Iraq. So that I wouldn't lose them before I could write the book. And as it turned out, I wound up writing the book just after I left the Army. But anyway, back to the Army Chief of Staff job. The service chiefs, of which I was one, are responsible for organizing, training, and equipping their services. And we provide trained and ready, in my case, soldiers to the combatant commanders across the world for employment on their military missions. It's interesting. I was the senior military officer in the Army, and I worked for a civilian, the Secretary of the Army, Pete Garin, and then John McHugh. A lot of people think that just because you're a four-star general, you tell everybody to do everything and you control all the troops. And the reality is, as I said, the services and the service chiefs have a specific mission just to prepare the troops for employment by the combatant commanders. And they are not in the operational chain of command. The operational chain of command runs from the president to the Secretary of Defense to the combatant commanders. So we have two civilians who exercise control over all the military forces in the United States. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs is in what we call the chain of communications. The Secretary of Defense and the president communicate their instructions to the military through the chairman, but he is not in the chain of command. So I guess the last thing I'd say is, I said organize, train, and equip. Basically, that means everything from recruiting the soldiers to come into the Army to coming up with the doctrine that those soldiers will employ to basically shaping what types of organizations will make up the Army. And then deciding what equipment they need and making that equipment and getting it out and produced into the force. So it's a huge job, and it's just a continuous mission.
Yeah. I can't imagine the type of stresses and pressures that come with that kind of job. That is huge responsibilities. I did want to ask a little bit about, okay, so you mentioned in your book that the U.S. Army Chief of Staff before you took over in 2003, I believe it was, You said they started the largest organizational transformation since World War II. That is fascinating. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, really, the Army had been transforming since the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and the Soviet Union collapsed a year or so later. And this was really just an acceleration of the transformation caused by the attacks on September 11th, because the result of those attacks were that the American military was thrust into a fundamentally different environment than we had been preparing for, certainly for the duration of my career, but really over the history of most of the Army. Up until that time, we in the military had trained to fight other militaries. And on September 11th, right, now we were thrust into an environment where now we had to deal with non-state actors, in this case, Al-Qaeda, that could inflict significant damage on a state, which they did to us on September 11th. And so we had to fundamentally change the way we thought about things. And of course, war against conventional armies didn't completely go away, as we've seen in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
So we had to adapt. And my predecessor felt that we were basically too much organized toward just conventional operations and not organized into a flexible enough array of forces that we could react to different kinds of operations that would be put into. And so that led to what you said was the largest organizational transformation of the Army since World War II.
That's really fascinating to think about all of these different changes that 9/11, like this ripple effect that you don't even really think about, all these changes that it just kind of bulldozed through all of our organizations.
Well, if you think about it, it had a huge impact on the intelligence community. It had a huge impact on the U.S. government with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, that was the largest governmental change in a long time.
Yeah. And that must have been really, I mean, for me, knowing absolutely nothing about military command and how to do that, that's terrifying to think of, well, now we have to switch into these non-state actors. Like, how do you even build on that? Where do you even start with that?
Well, you know, I think it's something that everybody is doing today, in not just in the military, but in their businesses. And it's a function for us then at the time, it was a function of having to figure out how to deal with non-state actors, but at the same time, having to deal with advances in technology.
And
the advances in technology just continued to accelerate, so we had to continue to adapt. And if I look at what's going on in Ukraine now and the use of drone warfare, you know, when I got to Iraq, there were three of the larger kinds of drones, three.
Three.
And they weren't necessarily under the Army's control. We had smaller drones and things like that, but the drone warfare developed and evolved over that time, and now is far more significantly in use.
Yeah, what a different world to three. Wow, that's wild to think about. Okay, so that brings me to the next question, which is about the revised Operations Field Manual in 2008. What kind of major things were different between the non-revised and the revised version?
Yeah, so really, Emily, that was our first attempt in the Army to produce a new doctrine since September 11th. Mm-hmm. So we had been in a war for about 7 years up to the time it was published. And they were already working on it when I took over the Army in 2007. But I felt that this was so important that I delved very, very heavily into it to make sure that we got it right, because, as I said, it was going to be the first Army doctrine since September 11th.
Such a big deal.
For the core of that doctrine was the realization that we were not just going to fight a conventional war, that we were going to have to do other things. And so we said that the Army would conduct what we call full spectrum operations, offense, defense, and stability operations simultaneously, and they would be conducted in different proportions depending on the kind of war that we were in. Because we felt that as an Army, we needed to be able to operate from the high-end conventional war all the way down to peacekeeping operations. That required different levels of interweaving those three elements: offense, defense, and stability operations. So that was the crux of it.
Wow. Okay. And some people may disagree with me here, but that kind of change reminds me a little bit of George Washington, the Revolutionary War. We had to take the British field operating manual and change it up a bit. And it was this huge thing that you had to just kind of be like, we're not fighting the same kind of old war that we used to fight. And this kind of reminds me a little bit of that. I don't know.
Well, that's the reality. War is exactly like the last one. And they'll always be different. And it's interesting. I do a course on civil-military relations at the University of Denver. And I actually just finished it. And one of the lessons that I look at case studies of three 20th century conflicts and two 21st century conflicts. And it's human nature. When you go through something as mind focusing as war, you're conditioned by it, and you can't help but look at the next war through the same lens that you had seen in the previous war. And it's just as I said, it's human nature.
Well, and it does contrast a bit to, let's say, like Napoleonic era, that kind of thing, where people hadn't quite transitioned over into the we need to think about what we're doing. I feel like back in the 19th century and in the 18th century, people were still fighting this very ordered way of war, like, oh, we have all this noble ideas about prisoner exchange and this and that, and it's just like a totally different world to have to regroup and think about all that.
Warfare, like anything else, continues to evolve, and you have to be successful, you have to continue to evolve with it.
Okay, so let's talk about what was your position overall in the overall role in the military during the Iraq War.
So let's see. I was the director of the joint staff when the war started. So I was basically the chief of staff to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and I helped him orchestrate the efforts of the joint staff in the Pentagon. And the joint staff directs actions and operations of all the services. That's where I started it. In October of 2003, I was promoted to 4 stars and took over the position as the vice chief of staff of the Army. And so I was the number two guy, the number two military guy in the Army.
Wow.
And from that position, I really oversaw the support for the war and also for the budget process that it took to get that support for the war. And then after that, I was only in that job about 9 months when I was selected by the president to go to Iraq, and I arrived in Iraq as the commander of the multinational force on the 1st of July, 2007.
That's incredible. It is so rare for us to be able to talk to somebody of your experience and your knowledge about these things. So again, thank you for being here. And I wanted to also say that I watched some of your talks that you've given about living in a VUCA world. Can you tell us about what that is?
Sure. And in fact, I'll tell you a story about how I got reintroduced to it. Shortly after I retired from the Army, I got a call from the dean of the Kenyon Flagler Business School at the University of North Carolina. And she said, "General, can you come down and talk to our executive MBA program on leading in a VUCA world?" I said, "Sure, Dean, no problem." And when I hung up, I Googled VUCA. And much to my embarrassment, I found out that it was a term coined by the United States Army War College in 1989 to describe what they thought the world would look like after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And that's the construct that I use when I talk in my MBA classes into business audiences about the world that they have to be able to adapt to and lead in.
Right. So, okay. So.
Oh, and I guess we probably ought to say what the acronym stands for. Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous.
That definitely seems to sum up a lot of the anxieties around that time when you think about everything going on back then in the late 80s.
I will tell you, people feel it's even more relevant today.
Actually, yeah, you're right. It's very relevant today when you think about it. I pretty much come across some feeling, some sentiment of that almost every day, actually. And so you said that we can no longer assume that we dominate any environment that the U.S. comes into. And that's a little terrifying. And it also makes sense. What do you think that started?
Well, it has to do with the type of war that you're fighting. And I think that what conversation that you're referencing, I was talking about the difference of transitioning from conventional war to unconventional war, like we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in conventional war, they're front lines, and the good guys are on one side and the bad guys are on the other. So you have a general idea of where that enemy is deployed and positioned. And, you know, for example, if you're on the front lines, you need a higher degree of armor protection than if you're in the rear, where the likelihood of conflict at that time was not very likely. When we went into Iraq, for example, the logistics soldiers in the rear weren't in the rear anymore. They were on the roads, mm-hmm. just like the combat soldiers. But we as an army hadn't invested in making sure that they had the type of armored protected vehicles that they needed to survive in this new environment. And so that's what I was saying earlier. Every war is different, and you have to continuously adapt to the new environments.
So speaking of evolving war, can you tell us a little bit about the Future Combat Systems program and what your involvement was in that, just what it is?
So the Future Combat System was the Army's major modernization program when I returned from Iraq and took over my job as the Army Chief of Staff. It was started by my predecessor twice removed. So there had been two Army Chiefs of Staff that had worked that program. It started in the late 90s, and it started as an attempt to realize the value of some of the new technologies that people envisioned. I mean, they weren't all there yet, but people saw the potential for them. And it was a very expensive program. It was about $1 billion program, and it involved both a network and different vehicles to operate within that network. Unfortunately, the technology didn't develop as fast as people thought it would. And frankly, the arcane defense procurement system made that even more, it made it even more difficult to acquire and bring on new technologies quickly. And then my immediate predecessor, as we talked about earlier, was conducting the largest reorganization of the Army since World War II. And he found different needs for the money that was tied up in the program. So they started moving money from the program into other programs. And so the time slipped. And when the time starts slipping, people start criticizing the program. And it picked up a lot of, I'd say, enemies, people who were opposed to the program. In the end, working with Secretary Gates, the program was killed. But the good thing was Secretary Gates, when he killed the program, as the $1 billion worth, he allowed us to keep the important things like the network and a new combat vehicle for the Army. So we learned an awful lot from it. In fact, it produced the Stryker vehicle, which was very effective for us in Iraq, and continues to be. So we got some good things out of it, but the program as a whole was finally killed in 2010, but we reaped the benefits from it.
I can imagine that happens quite a lot, these programs, and for whatever reasons, they just get killed at some point.
Yeah, well, you know, I remind people all the time, you know, we're all human and we can't predict the future. You have to look far enough ahead so you, you know, for example, it takes about 7 years for an idea to come to fruition, to get turned into a piece of equipment, to be manufactured and put out to the field to the troops. And so, you know, your idea has to be at least 7 years out, and then you have to follow through on the idea. But it's the best we're going to do. Yeah.
So the ones that we actually see coming out, like, made it across the finish line.
Yeah, they've been at it for a long time.
Wow. We should give them just a little bit more credit for making it that far then. And before we go, I do want to touch on, probably a lot of people have questions about 9/11 and Iraq and all these things. The biggest question that's probably been answered a million times is, why did we pivot so hard from going after those responsible for 9/11 to hunting down Saddam Hussein?
Yeah, I wouldn't quite characterize it that way, Emily. You know, we went into Afghanistan, well, I think by October 9th, shortly, very, very shortly after September 11th, and we completely decimated the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda operatives that were there. And so, honestly, after that time, they were no longer in a position to threaten us at home in the United States. I will tell you, people forget about that on the 18th of September, so just a week after September 11th, there was an anthrax attack on members of Congress and some media stations. They were mailed envelopes that contained anthrax, and anthrax is a biological weapon. Yeah. Five people died and 18 were hospitalized as a result of that attack. And
I remember that.
For me personally, who happened to be up on Capitol Hill that day and to have a meeting with a staffer, and I went up to the office, and the office was roped off with crime scene tape because the office had gotten one of the anthrax letters. And so it really struck home to me, really so close in the aftermath of September 11th, that really drove home to us in the military the danger of weapons of mass destruction in the hands of a terrorist organization. And even that little bit of anthrax had that level of impact. And so people forget that, you know, Saddam Hussein had been given 17 the UN Security Council resolutions asking him to come clean on his weapons of mass destruction, what he had. And he's had weapons, he had weapons inspectors from the United Nations in and out of Iraq several times. And they had records. And, you know, we saw records that said, okay, Saddam Hussein has tons of chemical weapons. And the Iraqis agreed, yep, they had tons of chemical weapons. So I personally believed that, that Saddam Hussein, Iraq, was in the possession of tons to chemical weapons. And he had used them against Iran and the Iran-Iraq war, and he had used them against his own people in Halabja, for example.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't any question that he had chemical weapons. And I personally believe that chemical weapons in the hands of Saddam Hussein, who had connections to terrorist organizations, not necessarily al-Qaeda, not direct connections to al-Qaeda, but it was too easy for someone with tons of chemical weapons to pass them off to a terrorist organization. And it wouldn't have to be Saddam Hussein himself. I mean, it could be some caretaker that could pass them off. And so I personally believe that in the post 9/11 environment, someone who had in the past had sponsored terrorism, to be in possession of chemical weapons was too great a threat to the United States. And I don't know if you remember seeing the picture of President Bush's face, and when he's talking to that kindergarten group in Louisiana on September 11th, and he's told the second tower has collapsed. You know, the number one responsibility of a president is to protect his people. And I can tell you, working with him, he resolved, I don't know if it was that day, but he resolved that it was never going to happen again on his watch. We were attacked by weapons of mass destruction, and we weren't going to be attacked again. And so to me, that's why we went to war in Iraq. That Saddam Hussein,
but
it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and when you think about, I'm kind of right there with you, where you start looking at Saddam's history, and you're like, oh, he's kind of prancing around, going, "Hey, I got chemical weapons," and he had used them on his own people, and 9/11 had just happened, and it was that uncertain world that you're talking about, that volatile, uncertain world, where chemical weapons could start being used. And anthrax is like, oh, it's just a letter. People send letters every day. It could be a random guy that gets his hands on it. You just don't know. And it is the responsibility of the president to look after the citizens of their country first and foremost. So that does make a lot of sense to me. And I think people just forget how much Saddam Hussein was kind of promoting the idea that he had the capabilities or that the desire.
Well, you know, when he was being interrogated after he was captured, they asked him, why didn't you just tell us that you had destroyed the chemical weapons? And he said, because I didn't want Iran to know. He still believed that Iran thought he had chemical weapons just like we did. And that was a deterrent.
Wow. Okay, so let's see here. When you took over, you had to go into meetings with these huge personalities like Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and all these people, and everybody had basically the same intention to protect everybody, but maybe different ideas about how to do that. Was there ever like a big struggle with trying to align everybody's goals and just like, no, don't do it this way, don't do it that way? Anything that sticks out to you?
Oh, sure. I mean, these are really deep, complicated strategic issues. And you would expect people to have different views. In fact, you would hope they had different views, because if you don't, you get a consensus opinion and that doesn't necessarily work out too well.
Yeah,
there was a there was lots of discussion about whether we needed yet another UN Security Council resolution, because at that time there were already 16. And some felt very strongly that we had all we needed. Others said, no, this is a new event, so we need to bring the international community along with us. And President Bush ultimately sided with them. That was probably that was one. Another was who should be in charge in the post-war era.
Okay.
Should it be Department of Defense? Should it be Department of State? That was there was a lot of friction over that, and ultimately the president put out a presidential decision memorandum that basically said the ambassador, the State Department, and the ambassador were responsible for politics, economics, and information, and the military, me, was responsible for security. And that turned out to be an appropriate division of labor. So those are the type of issues. It's interesting that there's lots of discussion but some things being written that President Bush never asked everybody for a vote. You know, should we do this? But you know, they had been working this for months. And expressing their opinions openly in the National Security Council meeting, and debating different issues, and by that time I think he felt he knew where everybody stood, so he didn't need to ask.
I mean, that makes sense. I think people criticize presidents for things without really having the whole context quite a lot. But that makes sense. Like, if you already know where everybody stands. Okay, so I wanted to ask a question about, I believe you mentioned something about the amount of ammunition being left behind in Iraq in Desert Storm in 91. Was that in your book? Yes, can you tell us about that compared to like what we left behind in Afghanistan in 2020? Like,
yeah,
what's the scale we're looking at here?
Yeah, two different issues. In Desert Shield, Desert Storm, it took us 6 months to flow the force and the logistical support ammunition over there. And then as it turned out, we didn't use about 80% of the ammunition that we shipped over there. And so it caused us to go back and refine our planning and to do a better job of figuring out what our needs really were. I don't mean this as a critique, but logisticians tend to be very risk averse. They're going to make sure that you have everything you need, no matter what happens. And so that kind of jacks up the stockpile. In Afghanistan, I was already out of the army, so I don't really know exactly what the decision process was, but I can see it. You know, the cost to ship vehicles and things that out of Afghanistan, put them on a boat, take them back to the United States, refurbish them, give them back to the troops. After they've been over in Afghanistan for just, say, a year or two, or even, 15, 20 years, and they're not in great condition to begin with. And the cost of doing that, I suspect, far outweighed the cost of leaving them there and buying new equipment back in the States. Now, that I don't know, but
yeah,
to me that's a calculation that I've heard before.
Me too. That I've seen that a lot. I wish that we would have just destroyed them or something.
Oh, I suspect they destroyed the stuff that would have been dangerous to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I know that we're approaching the end here. So before we go, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show and asking if there's anything else that you might be doing in the future that we can expect, any other books or projects you're working on.
No, I'm actually working on a leadership book right now where the things that I learned in my 41 years in the Army and my experience after the Army. And putting it into a book, and it's basically, I've honed it through 10 years of teaching leadership at the business school at Cornell, and about in 7 years in their executive education program, going to different businesses around the country, and then working on corporate boards, and profit and nonprofit. So I'll be able to have that out by the end of the year. I was actually just
very cool
checking my references this morning.
Oh yeah, that's the hardest part is the references and like double checking.
It is.
But that is very cool. I look forward to reading that. As I said, the book that I wrote, Strategic Reflections, was so good. It was so illuminating, and I felt that it was really good for somebody who didn't know. I don't know too much about the technicalities of warfare in the military, and I was able to follow along. So I think if anybody has any interest in the military and the Iraq War, I would highly recommend this book by General George Casey, Strategic Reflections. Very, very good book.
Well, thank you for the plug, Emily.
Yes, yes. Okay, so again, General George Casey, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope that people will read your book.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.